Russia, 1972. Deep in the basement of KGB headquarters, 50-year-old Vasily Matrokin scribbled furiously on a tiny piece of paper. Beads of sweat dripped from his brow. At any moment, a fellow archivist could walk in on him. As Matrokin listened for footsteps, he hoped it looked like he was just jotting down a grocery list. Well, he was making a list, all right. But instead of fruits and vegetables, it contained identities and code names. It revealed the names of the illegals. KGB operatives working deep undercover in the West disguised as foreign nationals. When he finished, he looked over his shoulder to make sure no one was coming. Then he stuffed the scrap of paper where he thought no one would ever check, the sole of his shoe. Matrokin knew if he were caught, he would most certainly be killed. As he walked down the hall to the exit, he felt his heartbeat quicken. The lump of secrets in his shoe began to press against his foot. The papers were tiny, but in this moment, their weight felt immense. He had been collecting secrets ever since he started working at the archives in 1956. Now, 16 years later, he was finally going to do something with them. But before he could share these secrets with the world, he had to get them out of the building. He approached the guard and readied himself for inspection. They normally checked bags and pockets, but would today be the day they looked closer? He looked at the guard, took a deep breath, and gave a solemn nod. The guard stared back at Matrokin and nodded back. With that, Matrokin walked out of the dark hallway into the bright Russian sunshine. He had successfully stolen KGB secrets. And now, he wanted to do it again. This is Espionage, the Parcast original exploring the missions of the world's most incredible spies and what brought their covert operations into the public eye. Now, throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm Carter Roy. You can find all episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Espionage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Espionage in the search bar. This is our first episode on Vasily Matrokin, the KGB archivist who has been called the greatest whistleblower in the history of the Soviet Union. For over 12 years, he painstakingly copied and smuggled documents out of KGB headquarters, building the most complete record of KGB operations anywhere. At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we are doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast, and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help. This week, we'll explore why Vasily Matrokin switched from spying for the Soviet Union to spying on them, and how he secretly copied and smuggled thousands of documents right out from under the KGB's nose. Next week, we'll follow Matrokin's escape from the collapsing Soviet Union, his fight to bring this information to light, and the dark secrets the KGB was desperate to keep hidden. Vasily Matrokin wasn't the kind of person you pictured when you imagined a spy. He was a family man, devoted to his wife and young son, with simple tastes like fishing and hiking the Russian countryside. He was a far cry from the sophisticated spies in the movies. Even his preferred meal choice was a plain vegetable soup made from his own garden. But Matrokin revealed more secrets about the inner workings of the Soviet Union than one could ever dream of. Vasily Matrokin was born on March 3, 1922, in the small village of Yurasovo, but grew up in Moscow. However, in Matrokin's eyes, the countryside was home. Despite the move to the city, The Matrokhin family kept their country house in Yurasava and returned to it often. But for the young Matrokhin, there was one constant in his life, whether he was in the city or the countryside: the Communist Party. Growing up, Matrokhin was instilled with deep loyalty to the Soviet Union. He became a true believer in the promises of communism and the Soviet project of equality for all. He was committed to serve his country in whatever way he could. He got his chance sometime around 1939, when the Soviet Union passed a law requiring mandatory military service for all citizens. Before the Soviet Union joined World War II in 1941, Matrokhin trained as an artillery fighter. But Stalin believed that a well-maintained archive was just as important as battlefield dominance. Instead of reporting to the front lines, the academically inclined Matrokhin was given the opportunity to study at the Historical Archives Institute in Moscow. As part of his studies, Matrokhin was sent to Kazakhstan to review the archive of files on the prisoners and operational practices in the now infamous gulags, Soviet forced labor camps. Living and working in unbearable conditions, prisoners, many of whom were political dissidents, worked up to 14 hours a day. The inmates were forced to do anything from carving canals out of the frozen ground with pickaxes to mining coal by hand. In many cases, prisoners died. Not that it really mattered, because the Soviet government sent trains full of new workers every day. The conditions in the gulag were horrendous. Matrokhin soon lost his taste for documenting and cataloging what he saw there. However, he still wanted to serve his country, so he quit the archive and went to law school. After graduating law school in 1944, Matrokhin worked both for the military and civilian police. His archival training made him a diligent and careful lawyer, and his work soon caught the attention of the Soviet Foreign Intelligence Office. In 1948, at the age of 26, Vasily Matrokhin became a spy for the Soviet Committee of Information, or KI. Now, Soviet spy training was shrouded in secrecy, and Matrokhin didn't discuss it. But by using a 1970s KGB manual provided by Russian intelligence journal The Interpreter, we can understand the instruction process Matrokhin went through. Even though the agency wasn't officially formed until 1954, KI agents most likely went through similar instruction as their KGB counterparts. When he began his training, Matrokhin was probably taken to a facility far outside of any city with a group of young men. They would all have been using assumed names, forbidden from sharing their real identities. There, he would have learned common tradecraft, like using a dead drop to pass intelligence to an agent or informant. Well, dead drops are secret locations, like a hole in a wall or a hollowed-out book, where sensitive information can be discreetly hidden for those in the know to find. But that's not all Matrokhin may have learned in his training. He also would have practiced brush passes, the art of subtly handing off intelligence while making momentary passing contact, often in public places. For their final test, new agents like Matrokhin were set loose in Moscow with a simple mission: drop information in a hidden place without being detected. Matrokhin would not have known who or how many people would be following him, so his first step would be something called proverka, meaning dry cleaning. This technique was a series of maneuvers designed to detect, and hopefully shake, anyone who was following him. Matrokhin would have walked a circuitous path, ducking in and out of hidden corners throughout the city. But the entire time, his mind would have been working overtime. If caught, he would have to come up with an immediate and plausible explanation for his behavior. Well, this was where Matrokhin would have learned one of the KGB manual's most important rules of working in foreign intelligence. You can't be a spy if you look like a spy. It wasn't just about being careful. He had to fit into his surroundings. Something as simple as being dressed too well for a certain restaurant, or meeting on the wrong street, could get him ousted as a spy. With his training complete, Matrokhin successfully passed his tests and began his espionage career. Starting in 1952, he worked on a series of foreign postings, going undercover in the Middle East, Iceland, the Netherlands, Pakistan, and Australia. But soon, Matrokhin's commitment to the Soviet cause was tested. One of his assignments was investigating an alleged conspiracy of Jewish nationalists, known as Zionists, within the USSR. Well, there was no official religion under communism, and Joseph Stalin saw any kind of powerful religious group as a danger to the party. He had designated Zionists as a high priority threat. But Stalin's motivations weren't solely for the good of the Communist Party. He had a long history of anti-Semitism and believed that Jewish people were covertly using the international banking system to subvert socialism. He also had a particular hatred of Jewish doctors and had an irrational suspicion that they used their expertise to murder non-Jews. On January 13, 1953, the official Soviet Union newspaper Pravda declared that 9 Soviet doctors, 6 of whom were Jewish, had murdered 2 of Stalin's top aides. Known as the Soviet Doctor's Plot, this false accusation was intended to kick off a secret plan to send the country's 2 million Jews to the gulags. But as the plan was being set in motion, Stalin died suddenly on March 5, 1953. However, even with Stalin out of the picture, the plot against the USSR's Jewish people continued. A few days after Stalin's death, the 31-year-old Matrokhin was sent on a mission to Paris. His assignment was to investigate a Yuri Zhukov, a foreign correspondent for Pravda. He was suspected of leading a secret Zionist network and working to wipe out the leadership of the Soviet Union. But as he investigated Zhukov, Matrokhin realized Zhukov was a man a lot like himself, a hard-working patriot committed to the Soviet cause. One thing he did learn, however, was that Zhukov's French wife was Jewish. It was clear that the only thing that had attracted the Foreign Intelligence Office's attention was the ethnic background of the reporter's wife. The affair made Matrokhin begin to wonder. If Zhukov was clearly innocent, perhaps the Jewish doctors implicated in the Soviet doctor's plot were innocent as well. For the first time, Matrokhin saw his assignment for what it was: a paranoid conspiracy. There was no fire, there wasn't even any smoke. Matrokhin's suspicions proved to be correct. Sometime in late March or early April, Stalin former head of security, Lavrenty Pavlovich Beria, made a public statement admitting that the Zionist plots never existed. It had been a figment of Stalin's imagination, and the rest of the government had followed along blindly. The 9 doctors were cleared of charges. 7 were released, but the other 2 had already been killed while in prison. Matrokhin was furious about those injustices. Beria's admission, however, left Matrokhin feeling strangely hopeful. Communism wasn't the cause of all the paranoia, conspiracy, and violence Matrokhin had witnessed. Stalin was. And now that Stalin was dead, it was time for a new leader to step forward and save the country he loved. Matrokhin waited for new leadership to emerge. He loved his job in foreign intelligence and desperately wanted to believe that he was working for good. Change seemed to arrive in February 1956. Nikita Khrushchev, the new leader of the Soviet Union, gave a speech during a closed session of the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. His talk, entitled "On the Cult of Personality and Its Consequences," became famously known as the Secret Speech. For the first time ever, Khrushchev acknowledged Stalin's abuses of power and blamed it all on what he called Stalin's cult of personality. Khrushchev promised that the future would be different. Despite not being broadcast or printed, word still spread about Khrushchev's unprecedented announcement. Matrokhin learned about the speech when it was debated during a meeting of his KGB Communist Party branch. Now, the branch vigorously debated Khrushchev's speech for 2 days. Some members were still too afraid to criticize their fallen leader. Others were relieved to be able to finally acknowledge the corruption that was all around them. But the 34-year-old Matrokhin couldn't help but wonder where Khrushchev was when Stalin was committing these crimes. Matrokhin's belief in communism was still strong, but his faith in his government was waning, and it was time for him to start taking action. Matrokhin knew that he couldn't speak out against the government without getting in trouble. This was the Soviet Union, after all. But he called on his years of spy training to give him ideas. He began to write anonymous letters to newspapers in protest of certain government decisions. One that particularly enraged Matrokhin was when the Soviet government banned the great Russian author Boris Pasternak's novel Dr. Zhivago in 1956 because it criticized Stalin and the gulags. But even as he wrote, Matrokhin knew that an anonymous letter was never really anonymous. Government spies would search for little clues that could give away his identity. So he wrote in his left hand to disguise his handwriting. Following the official KGB manual for proper protocol for communication with undercover agents, he likely also used gloves to seal the envelope to guard against fingerprints. Even with all his spy training, though, Matrokhin was still at risk. He worried that a KGB lab might be able to deduce his identity from the saliva he left on the envelope. Though he wasn't sure if technology that could make the detection even existed, he knew that speaking out was worth taking a chance. Matrokhin could have lived like that for years. Soviet spy by day, frustrated anonymous letter writer by night. But later, in 1956, after only a few months of writing letters, his career took an unexpected turn. He was taken away from his intelligence work and sent to the archives, back in the basement of the Foreign Intelligence Service. Matrokhin was never given an explanation for his demotion. Maybe the higher-ups got wind of his dissatisfaction, or perhaps his skills were simply needed elsewhere. Well, whatever the reason, Vasily Matrokhin was no longer a spy. Instead, he was back to filing and organizing evidence of Soviet atrocities. Little did Matrokhin know that what he discovered in these files would change the course of history, and that he wasn't done being a spy yet. Coming up, Vasily Matrokhin spies once again, but this time against his own government. And now back to the story. In 1956, 34-year-old KGB agent Vasily Matrokhin had gone from proud Soviet communist to politically disillusioned dissident. After roughly 5 years of intelligence service out in the field, he found himself brought back home to Moscow and back in the archives. What was originally perceived as a demotion soon became a blessing. Matrokhin realized that he had firsthand access to sensitive government information. Everything from political killings to human rights abuses to the real identities of covert Soviet agents, all at his fingertips. But despite reading this litany of Soviet atrocities, Matrokhin still held out for things to get better in the Soviet Union. For the next 12 years, he diligently went about his job at the archives, doing little more than writing the occasional anonymous letter. In the 12 years he toiled in the archives, the Cold War grew more intense. In 1957, the Soviets beat the US in the space race with the launch of Sputnik, the first man-made satellite. 5 years later, in 1962, the U.S. and the Soviet Union got the closest they would ever come to nuclear warfare when the U.S. discovered Soviet missiles in Cuba. For 13 days in October, the world was on the edge of their seats waiting for a nuclear war to erupt. Thankfully, it never came. 2 years later, in 1964, Khrushchev was removed from power and replaced by Leonid Brezhnev. Brezhnev worked towards a détente between the USSR and the West. In July of 1968, the United States, Soviet Union, and 60 other countries signed a nuclear non-proliferation treaty to limit the spread of nuclear weapons around the globe. It looked as if an end to the Cold War was on the horizon. But within the Soviet Union, tensions between the oppressive government and its citizens were on the rise. Violence was about to erupt, leaving Vasily Matrokhin no choice but to return to his life as a spy. In the spring of 1968, while 46-year-old Matrokhin was on an archival assignment in East Berlin, Matrokhin learned that the satellite Soviet state of Czechoslovakia had chosen a new president, Alexander Dubček. Dubček promised to make extensive reforms that would liberalize the country's Soviet-installed communist government. Activists called it the Prague Spring, and it looked to be the kind of non-corrupt communism that Matrokhin had been hoping for. In Moscow, however, Soviet leaders began to fear that socialism with a human face was a little too close to capitalism. And on August 21, 1968, the Kremlin sent tanks into Prague to suppress the movement. Change to the Soviet system had once again been stopped by those in power. Matrokhin went back to the archives in Moscow, frustrated. And as he was filing papers about the Prague Spring, he saw that a number of illegals, deep undercover KGB agents living under assumed identities, were involved in suppressing the movement. Matrokhin dug deeper and concluded that more illegals had been deployed during the Prague Spring than for any operation in any Western country. If his life had turned out different, he could have been one of those illegals. It made him sick to think that he could have been spying on his fellow Soviets. This was the final straw for Matrokhin. He still believed in the idea of communism, but he was finally convinced that the men in charge of it were irredeemable. He had access to the information to destroy them. The first question was, how to spread it? Matrokhin knew of collectives of dissidents and political rebels who were collecting and self-publishing material known as Samizdat. Well, many of these documents, including one called the Chronicle of Current Events, were about physical and mental health abuses by the Soviet government, as well as persecution of religious groups. Matrokhin thought he could use the same techniques these rebels used to make Samizdat to release his information. According to Russia Beyond author Yekaterina Aleva, the Samizdat documents were copied by hand, sometimes using carbon copies, sometimes longhand with a ballpoint pen on newsprint. Hand-bound books were created using typewriters and then quietly passed from person to person. Samizdat material was even smuggled out of the Soviet Union into democratic countries with the hope of bringing global attention to these atrocities. The punishment for being found with Samizdat was severe. It could include prison time or death. Matrokhin didn't care. He read Samizdat publications whenever he could get his hands on them, but before he could even think of sharing any information himself, he needed to answer a second question: how to smuggle it out? Matrokhin had to wait around 4 years for his chance. In the summer of 1972, the Foreign Intelligence Service moved out of its office in the KGB headquarters in Moscow's Red Square to a new building in Yasenovo, half a mile beyond the Moscow Ring Road. 300,000 archived files needed to be checked by hand before they departed KGB headquarters and upon arrival at Yasenova. And the person in charge of this massive operation was none other than 50-year-old Vasily Matrokin. Even though he had been working in the archives for years, there was still a risk that pulling up files could draw the wrong kind of attention. But now that he was in charge of the project, it was his personal responsibility to touch each and every piece of paper within the KGB's records. This was his chance to collect all the evidence he could about the KGB's history of illegal operations and human rights abuses. But he couldn't release anything yet. If his plan was exposed, thousands of classified documents would remain buried in the archives. Before Matrokin acted, he wanted to collect all the information he could. For the moment, his focus was on building his own secret archive. Matrokin formulated a plan to get the information out without arousing suspicion. He committed names and facts to memory and wrote them down when he got home. Then he hid his hand-copied notes under his bed or in other secret places in his apartment. But that proved to be too slow, and there was always the possibility that he could misremember something. Matrokin knew he needed accurate copies of the files, just like the Samizdat papers he had read. This came with a bigger risk. But if he wanted to expose the hypocrisy of the Soviet Union, he knew he needed accurate information. As Matrokin reviewed his files, he took notes in tiny handwriting, then crumpled the papers and threw them in the trash. He didn't want to risk anyone seeing the papers on his desk or one accidentally falling out of his pocket. At the end of the day, he discreetly dug his notes out of the trash, stuffed them into his shoes, and then carefully made his way past the guards on his way out of the building. His weekly schedule was as follows. On Mondays, Tuesdays, and Fridays, he would make copies of the files as they arrived in the new office in Yasenova. On Thursdays, he would ready files for transport from the old KGB headquarters to the new building. On weekends, he would take his notes to his family's country house and hide them for safekeeping. But on Wednesdays, Matrokin found himself deep in the bowels of the old KGB archive, working on the files deemed too sensitive to transport, the ones detailing the legendary Directorate S, the division that recruited and trained the so-called illegals. This was the holy grail of KGB secrets. Field agents' assignments, code names, and even their original Russian identities. If foreign governments like the U.S. got their hands on this information, it would have meant certain death for everyone involved. Vasily Matrokin calmly copied these priceless state secrets and hid them in his shoes. He still didn't know what he was going to do with this information, but gathering it was the first step. Months went by. Then, years. Matrokin settled into his routine and grew more comfortable. He was a trusted supervisor, and no one suspected he was up to something. And soon enough, he could get past the security guards without breaking a sweat. However, he didn't let himself get too comfortable. Even though he spent most of his time in the archives, Matrokin was still a spy. He knew there was always a chance of being tailed by agents from the surveillance or counterintelligence directorates. The Soviet government was always suspicious, and Matrokin knew they weren't above spying on their own people. So Matrokin deployed his best tradecraft to avoid getting caught. He would vary the route he took home from work, knowing that a predictable pattern makes it easier for someone to be followed. He took care to blend in at work and around the city, since standing out in any way might attract unwanted attention. But one day, Matrokin's worst fears were realized. Someone was interested in him, and they wanted to ask Matrokin a couple of questions. Coming up, Vasily Mitrokhin's archive is in danger of exposure, and the fall of the Berlin Wall adds a new layer of urgency to his operation. And now, back to the story. Beginning in 1972, 50-year-old Soviet archivist Vasily Mitrokhin became fed up with the atrocities he was forced to document. Despite not having an endgame, he began to smuggle out damning information from the KGB archives and hide it in the apartment he shared with his wife and child. For years, he was careful about making sure no one was onto him, but soon it appeared that he had been caught. One day, Mitrokhin stopped off the local sports shop associated with the Moscow-based professional soccer team, Dynamo FC. As he was browsing, he found himself near two other patrons speaking to each other in English. Initially, Mitrokhin thought nothing of it. Well, this was exactly the kind of place that a foreigner might stop in, especially a soccer-loving Englishman. But then he was seized with a terrifying thought. KGB agent training specifically warned against meeting in cafes or other places where foreigners are known to gather. Agents were also encouraged to meet after work, in places with busy street life. If there was someone tailing him, Mitrokhin feared that he had inadvertently led them to what looked like the perfect information drop. He could feel the slight bulge in his shoe where he had stashed that day's batch of notes. He couldn't afford to be stopped and searched. If he was, then he would be immediately caught, and he knew exactly what kind of punishment he would get. He would be tried in secret and shot in the back of the head in the KGB execution cellar. Mitrokhin's spy training had alerted him to this danger, and he knew this same training could help him get out of it. If caught, it was important to have a plausible alibi, some reason to explain why he ended up in a sports shop surrounded by Englishmen. Mitrokhin moved away from the foreigners, but not too quickly to draw suspicion. Then he stopped by any other sporting shop he could find in the area. Well, this way, any agent following him would believe that he was actually out on a shopping trip. He stopped in shop after shop, inconspicuously looking over his shoulder to see if he was being followed. The coast seemed clear. Mitrokhin turned the corner and headed home, breathing a sigh of relief. But as he approached his apartment building, he noticed something unusual. There, in the window of his ninth-floor hallway, he spotted two shadowy figures standing in front of his own apartment door. Mitrokhin stood on the street corner, wondering what to do. He could run, but that could draw attention, and they would just be able to find him later. He had a wife and child, so he couldn't just disappear without a trace. As he saw it, the only option was to face this head-on. Mitrokhin made the long ascent to the ninth floor, rehearsing in his head how he would respond to the men. He'd done his Proverka maneuvers to shake any potential tails, and he'd taken care to build a convincing alibi. He was shopping for sporting gear. Nothing unusual about that. He adjusted his speed. Walking too quickly or too slowly would draw attention. Part of him never wanted to reach his front door, but he knew there was no getting around the confrontation. His heart was beating fast, and his palms were sweating, just like that first trip out of the archives with the notes in his shoes in 72. If there was ever a moment he needed his spy training to come through, it was right now. Mitrokhin rounded the final corner and saw his apartment door for the first time. It was closed. The hallway was empty and quiet. He walked from end to end, checking behind corners. Nobody was there. The men had disappeared. Mitrokhin hurried inside and locked the door, half thankful for his luck, half worried they would return. Well, despite the close call, Matrokin didn't stop smuggling out documents. If anything, he expanded his operation. After years of observing the security guards at the KGB facilities, he concluded that they never checked the workers' bags or briefcases. They would only pat down the workers themselves. And since Matrokin was the boss, he was never checked. So Matrokin escalated his work, taking notes on larger and larger pieces of paper and transporting them in his jacket pockets and pants. He still didn't have a plan for what to do with these secrets. His only goal was to collect as much dirt as possible. Each night, he took his plans home and hid them underneath his mattress. And every weekend, he would take his notes to the family's country house in Yurasova, 47 miles from Moscow. Ever the spy, he would dress in peasant clothes and stuff his papers in an old rucksack to avoid attracting attention. Safe in the country, he spent the weekends typing up, reviewing, and organizing the Soviet secrets he had unearthed. He would stack the typed pages in a milk churn and bury it in the ground under the raised floor of the country house. And there was just enough space in the basement for Matrokin to maneuver the churn, though he often found himself contending with dog and cat feces or live rats. But he thought to himself that if it was this hard for him, then a burglar would never make the effort. Eventually, he was smuggling out so many papers that he didn't have enough time on the weekends to type them all out, so Matrokin started burying his original handwritten notes. Over time, his collection of documents grew to fill the butter churn, as well as a tin clothes boiler, two tin trunks, and two aluminum cases. A treasure trove of state secrets buried under an unassuming country home. It was easy to assume that his documents were safer in such peaceful surroundings than they would be in Moscow. But the countryside had dangers of its own. Sometime in the 1970s, Matrokin was at his country house when he heard a strange noise coming from the attic. And it sounded more human than animal. Matrokin was immediately struck by a story he had heard about the famous Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn. A few years before, a friend of Solzhenitsyn's had paid him a surprise visit at his country house. Solzhenitsyn wasn't home, but the friend found two KGB officers looking through his papers. The officers called for backup and beat Solzhenitsyn's friend within an inch of his life. They wanted him to serve as a warning to Solzhenitsyn about what happens when you cross the Soviet government. Matrokin feared this might be his fate. Perhaps someone at the office had grown suspicious of him. Perhaps an agent tailing him had picked up on something unusual. The floorboards creaked again. Matrokin knew there was no escape. If the KGB suspected him, there was nothing to be done but face his fate. Suddenly, a figure emerged from the shadows. Matrokin felt his breath catch in his chest as he quickly took in as much visual information as he could. The man was painfully thin and shabbily dressed, too conspicuous to be an undercover agent. The man asked for forgiveness. He was just a homeless squatter looking for someplace warm. Matrokin and his archive were safe for the time being. Now, the stranger in the attic was Matrokin's last great scare as a KGB spy. In 1984, at the age of 62, he retired, leaving behind the archive he so carefully tended. But retirement meant that Matrokin could focus on his secret archive. He returned to his family's country house, thinking he would spend a year organizing his notes before finding a way to get them into the hands of someone who could make use of them. 1 year passed, then two, then five, and Matrokin kept typing. He produced 10 volumes in total and still had 30 large envelopes of uncategorized notes. but he still had no idea how to get them out. He entertained any idea that popped into his head. Some were reasonable, like getting a position on the local party committee that allowed for foreign travel. And some were more ridiculous, like stealing a small airplane from a local sports club and flying to Finland. Then, on November 9, 1989, when Vasily Matrokhin was 67 years old, the Berlin Wall came down. Soviet control was waning, which meant now was Matrokhin's best chance to get his archive to the West. By this point, he knew that the only way to get his archive out of Russia was to go with it. Not only did he want to make sure his information was understood, he knew his life could be at risk if he stayed. In 1991, the USSR officially disintegrated. The new Russian Federation struggled to set up borders and checkpoints between itself and the newly independent republics. The chaos gave Matrokhin his best chance to get out. In March 1992, the 70-year-old Matrokhin boarded an overnight train from Moscow to Riga, the capital of the newly independent country of Latvia. It had been years since he was an active spy, but he still remembered his training. Just like it said in the KGB manual, Matrokhin made sure to fit in with his surroundings. A stuffy-looking academic might arouse suspicion, but a desperate old man seeking asylum could easily pass under the radar. He intentionally wore disheveled clothes and dragged a beat-up case on wheels, hoping he would appear just like any harmless grandfather. But in that case, under the layers of bread, sausages, and clothing, lay pages from Matrokhin's secret archive. After decades of meticulous note-taking and volume creating, he was finally going to smuggle his secrets out of Russia and into the hands of the West. Even though the Soviet Union had collapsed, he was still risking his life. If he was caught with his notes before he got to the border, he would face certain death. But Matrokhin wasn't thinking about the risk. He was thinking about getting his archive into the right hands. There was only one question left on his mind. Would anyone believe him? Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back next Friday with the conclusion of Vasily Matrokhin and his archive. We'll explore his harrowing escape and how his secrets exposed the deep inner workings of the KGB. For more information on Vasily Matrokhin, amongst the many sources we used, we found The Sword and the Shield and The World Was Going Our Way by Christopher Andrew and Vasily Matrokhin, extremely helpful to our research. You can find more episodes of Espionage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Well, not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Espionage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Espionage on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Espionage in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Andy Waits, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Joel Stein, and Carly Madden. This episode of Espionage was written by Margaret LeBron. I'm Carter Roy.